We're going to play another song now from a young lady who is going to be joining us momentarily, Becca Loeb. She's part of this group called Nobody's Girl, and it's a trio. It's a female trio, but she's also got solo albums, as do the other women in the group. And we're going to talk to her about the new release. It's pretty tasty stuff, aptly titled Nobody's Girl, self-titled. So let's play one all about clicking your heels, I think. It's called Kansas.
Kissing, you did your time. You didn't know what you were missing. All secondhand ambition till you went drifting down the double yellow line. You went from black and white to Technicolor.
In Kansas anymore. New music, lead off track from Nobody's Girl, a trio of gifted young women that all have their own solo careers but have gathered together to give us this incredible album. It's got 11 tracks on it. One cover that I remember so far away, I believe it was an old Carole King song. But this is a great record. If you get a chance, check it out. It is officially released now, I do believe. It's called WeAreNobodysGirl.com is where you'll find information. And we have one of the ladies with us right now. We've got Becca Loeb. How are you?
I'm great. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I've been checking out your stuff. I signed up and got your covers album that you got, the secondhand songs. I've been getting all your press stuff, and I'm getting to know you as a former high school wrestler and all the fun things that you share with your fans.
You're getting the deep dive.
I am. I'm loving it. I've had a real fondness lately. I've been discovering some of the artists that are perhaps under the pop radar. Artists like Maya Sharp and Crystal Bowersox and yourself and the girls. It's my new thing. You get into those grooves where certain kinds of music, trip your trigger, and the female soloists, the Americana groove is kind of my thing right now.
I love that. Welcome.
Yeah. So tell me all about this. You have had several albums out on your own. I do want to touch a little bit on the fact that you were a contestant on The Voice, which, of course, is huge in pop culture. But I'm not a big, big fan of talent shows. I'm more I like to let the talent, wean itself out into the studio and judge it on its own rather than compete it against everyone. I don't think music should be a competition. I think music should be what it is, in the eye of the interpreter, in this case, the ear of the interpreter. So let's start off with, first of all, how you got into music. You were, as I was saying, I just got it this morning, you were a high school wrestler, you were the valedictorian, you used to schlep beer at ballparks. I mean, you got quite the colorful background. So how did you get into music?
Well, I started as just a little kid who just sang constantly, wouldn't shut up. My mom thought that I talked to myself a lot when I was, a toddler, and it turns out I was just always singing. And I just never stopped. My parents got me voice lessons when I was a little kid, too young to take voice lessons, but I wanted them so bad. Mm-hmm. And they consulted with a local voice teacher who said, that I was too young to formally train for voice. And they schemed and got me quote unquote lessons, like air quote, placebo lessons with the local piano teacher who just sung karaoke tapes with me and kept my enthusiasm sort of, stoked. And then when I was a little bit older in high school, my parents took me to that more serious vocal coach, and I did really kind of formal classical voice training, singing Italian arias and stuff.
Wow.
And by that time, I had also been playing guitar for a little while. I had a great middle school music teacher who made sure that there were always guitars available in the classroom, and she'd come in early every Friday to teach, free group guitar lessons to any kids who wanted to learn. Suzanne Scholl is her name. She's a wonderful educator. We're still very close. And, between those things, I started writing poetry as a preteen, and I took my terrible preteen poetry and my terrible preteen guitar playing and mushed them together, and suddenly I was writing terrible preteen folk songs. And I just kept going and started going to open mics and seeing other performers and got really inspired and decided that I wanted to pursue music professionally. So I only applied to music colleges. I got into some of them. I got into my first choice, which was Berkeley in Boston, where I went and studied audio engineering and a little bit of songwriting and performance and all that.
Wow. So you've been doing this for a while.
In a nutshell.
The two ladies that you're with, how did this group come about? There's three of you on this.
Yes. Nobody's Girl is me, Rebecca Lobey, along with Grace Pettis and Betty Sue, and they're both tremendous songwriters, and we've all known and really admired each other since we met. It's funny, we were just talking last night. We all met at the Kerrville Folk Festival in 2008, and it was actually the first year any of us had been there, and I think we all assumed that the other two had been going for years and already knew everybody, but we were all brand new, and we met each other, separately. Betty Sue and I were in the songwriting competition. Grace was singing around the campfires. We all met kind of one-on-one, and then continued to just bounce around each other for the next decade. I'd played gigs with both Grace and Betty Sue separately, and they had both played gigs with each other and with me, obviously. And back in 2017, I was looking for something to do in the spring, the following spring of 2018. I'm a bit of a schemer. I'm a bit of a sort of type A, eye on the horizon, march towards it, businessy go-getter. I like the creative business challenges of running a small music empire.
Mm-hmm.
So I called my friend Grace Pettis, and I asked if she'd like to put together what they call a package tour, where we take our, we take our shows on the road together. You get three artists together, you get your booking agents all working together, you try and book slightly bigger venues and share each other's audiences with one another. So Grace and I decided to do that together, and Betty Sue was our top choice for the third person to bring on the tour. And much to both of our surprise, she said yes. We both thought, well, there's no way we'll get Betty Sue, but let's just see if she'll do it. So we called and she said, yeah, that sounds like fun. So we agreed to do 1 3-week tour, and it was 8 months away. We had plenty of time to prepare. We did a photo shoot. We recorded a video. And the video out on Facebook got shared like many, many hundreds of times. It was an acoustic cover of Fast Car. And long story medium, it resulted in us getting offered a record deal by a label just outside of Austin. And we decided, you know, well, this has some momentum and we don't want to stop a moving train, so let's just see what happens. And we ended up signing a record deal and recording an album of original songs that we wrote as a band before we had ever actually played a gig together. It was if you told me that story, if I saw that story in a movie, I'd say, that's not how the music industry works. That's crazy. But wow. That's how it worked for us.
So did you write these songs for this specific album for Lucky Hound Music?
Yes, sir, we did. So at the beginning of the process, we decided to make things really hard on ourselves.
Okay, of course. Decided, why not?
We decided that rather than using songs that any of us had written, you know, on our own and just, you know, kind of not used for other projects or whatnot, that we were going to do 3-way co-writes for every song we released, except for a couple of covers, as Nobody's Girl. So, and we make an effort to cover artists that we admire, and so we have a sort of a habit of recording 2 covers per album, one of a, you know, well-known songwriter and one of a local Austin hero. So the Austin heroes that we've recorded songs by, you might want to add this to your list of under the radar folk pop divas. One is Raina Rose, who is a just terrific singer-songwriter based in Austin, and she wrote a song called Blue Bonnets that appeared on our first EP, Waterline, and then Eliza Gilkison, who is just a living legend in Austin.
Right.
And we recorded her song Beauty Way for the new record.
Wow. Excellent. The I like your treatment of Carole King, So Far Away. I'm a big Carole King fan. You. I had the opportunity to work early on in her career with Louise Goffin, her daughter, and when she was signed to Elektra. And I just love the whole sound of that family. You know, Jerry's writing and Carol's writing and performing, and Louise, another one of those that I still play, Kid Blue. I still pull that out and play it every once in a while. How did you choose which songs to play as far as the covers? You mentioned a couple of the local heroes, but how did you choose like a Carole King? That song in particular, not one of her better known hits. It's a hit, but it's not one of the biggest ones.
You know, it's funny. We somehow just landed on wanting to do a Carole King song. And originally the record was supposed to come out in 2020, so it wasn't even going to time up with the 50th anniversary of Tapestry. I think it's just a record that we all really resonate with and started as a conversation. Wouldn't it be amazing to do a Carole King song? And we played, you know, we sat around and we played around with a few of them, and they're all classic songs, but it's a matter of feeling out which one felt right as a band. And we started with a different one, thinking that was going to be the one. Mm-hmm. And it sounded good. It sounded fine. But then something wasn't clicking. We were struggling to find the right arrangement. So we just sort of, you know, just to change it up, we switched gears. Said, well, let's try So Far Away. And it just really clicked. It felt something about it just resonated with each of us in that moment emotionally. And it just felt like we needed to capture it.
Now, how do you decide between the three of you being independently successful singer-songwriters, how do you decide who steps up and does lead on a certain song? And do you break it up equally, or does the song pick the singer?
A little bit of everything.
Okay.
You know, with the first record, and with our first album, Waterline, we were brand new. I mean, like I said, we never actually played a show before. And we did it more like a round-robin singer-songwriter, you know, package tour in the round configuration, where I'd sing lead on one song and Betty Sue and Grace would sing harmony, and Betty Sue would sing lead on another song and me and Grace would sing harmony. And there were 6 songs on that EP, and we each sing lead on 2 songs, and it was very easy to kind of keep track of. But on the new record, we decided very, very early on, Kansas, the song you just played, was actually mm-hmm. the first song we wrote for the record at our very first writing session specifically for this album. And the way it just came out, we all were swapping verses back and forth, and it felt right. And that was something we had discussed previously and thought that it seemed like an impossible thing to do, like switching lead and harmonies throughout the whole record. That's crazy. But
right.
it just evolved that way. So, wow. And now we switch constantly. We switch usually one of us will do a whole verse and then another one will do the whole chorus. But sometimes, I mean, on So Far Away, for example, and a lot of songs on the record, we actually switch within verses. You know, I'll sing two lines and then Grace will sing a line and a half, and then Betty Sue finishes that line and carries it into the chorus. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's very fluid, and it's like the lead vocal is just sort of ping-ponging across the stage. And although we all have, I think, very different characters to our voice, somehow when we sing together, we are sort of all just, I don't know, I don't want to get too woo-woo on you, but we're all channeling the same energy. It's like even our moms can't tell who's singing sometimes. It's really crazy.
Yeah. Because it's hard to determine who's singing what as you listen to these. And if you're, like, finishing each other's lines, then there is definitely some kind of chemistry there.
Totally. Well, and I didn't answer your question as to how. And the answer is, honestly, it just sort of, it happens. It's a four-way discussion between the three of us and the producer. And, you know, sometimes it has to do with who connects emotionally more with a particular line. Like, well, this line's especially meaningful to me. I'd really like to be the one who sings it. Okay, you get to sing it. Or this is great in Betty Sue's registers. Let's send her in there. Or, you know, Grace, you know, came up with that hook on the chorus. Let's go have her wail it out. You know, so some of it just kind of happens passively as, you know, as we all sort of just step into the roles that feel most comfortable. And then our producer, the wonderful Michael Ramos, was sort of keeping an eye on the big picture. It's like, well, you know, we've had a lot of Grace recently, so how about Betty Sue? You hop in there. Or, you know, Betty Sue sounds great on that first line, so let's have her do it, and then we'll have Grace come back. You know, that's sort of, does that answer your question?
Yes.
Not that
yes.
glamorous of a process.
Yes. you mentioned Waterline coming out earlier as a first album. That was an EP in 2018. You have mm-hmm. Waterline on this album. Is it the same version, or did you re-record it?
Yeah, no, we believe in recycling.
Okay. Now, this was the first song you guys wrote together?
The first song we wrote was actually a song called Queen City, which we wrote, it's on the Waterline EP. We wrote Queen City thinking, we went on a little overnight songwriting retreat. This was after our Fast Car video went mini viral in the Austin folk music scene, and some folks who owned a recording studio outside of town invited us to come out and have a little writing retreat. So we went out and thought, well, let's try and write something all together that we can finish our shows with, you know, have like a big co-write closer, and then we'll all sing Kumbaya. It'll be great.
Mm-hmm.
So we had brought some wine. We had snacks. We had, you know, about 18 hours set aside, and we started writing Queen City. You know, I think I had a little guitar riff in mind, and Grace had this story about a Roma queen from Mississippi, and we all put on our nerd hats and tried to impress each other with how much research we could do writing a piece of historical fiction. And it was really fun, and the harmonies really clicked, and the whole thing was done in about 3 hours. We thought, well, I guess we should open the wine. So then we opened the wine, and then we just started jamming and sharing songs. And a few hours later, it was getting late. We'd had dinner, and we thought, like, well, we could go to bed, but maybe we should try writing something else. So then we wrote the song What'll I Do, which also appeared on both the EP and is now on the album. So we wrote the song called What'll I Do, which is a really kind of fun, brassy pop song about, you know, about a meddlesome boy who you probably shouldn't have a crush on, but you do.
Mm-hmm.
And in the morning, we started writing out the storm. So when the folks who owned the studio came in to bring us breakfast tacos, they asked if they could hear what we'd written so far, and we sang them those three songs. And they said, well, that sounds great. Do you guys want a record deal? And that's how that came together. And then the next song we wrote when we realized we had to fill out an EP was a song called Waterline.
Well, let's go back and play What'll I Do. And again, this is the original version. You recycled this.
And some keyboard parts and, you know, remixed it.
Okay.
It's got a little bit more, it's instrumentally changed a bit from the version on the EP, but just a teeny tiny bit. We recycled most of it.
All right. This is the newer version, the recycled version, Nobody's Girl, self-titled album. We'll be back with Becca in just a minute. Check this out.
Pulling for it.
What'll I Do? That's a track off Nobody's Girl, and this is brand new stuff just out. I believe it's out now. Is that correct? It came out in June
comes
or July?
1 week from today.
Oh, 1 week from today. Okay.
Mm-hmm. But everybody can pre-save it on Spotify if they feel so inclined.
All right. What'll I Do? A great song about falling for the bad boy, I guess. Calling after midnight, a little booty call after that, and you're singing about it. Love it.
I think we all really love the line in that song. is that, so you told me you got a new tattoo. I can see you. Oh God, now I'm forgetting the line, but you got a new tattoo. Is that supposed
to
be
a Van Gogh? Yeah.
And so we've got a shirt we've designed that's like a horrible drawing of Van Gogh. It says, is that supposed to be Van Gogh? And I don't know if anyone's going to like this shirt but us, but we all love it.
Is that the art that's on the website?
Not yet.
Okay.
It's coming soon.
All right. Now, you guys are going to be going on tour. I'm looking at your site now, and folks, you can go to it at wearenobodysgirl.com. On the tour page, it looks like you're going to be hitting in August. You're doing something July 30th, but it looks like it's a big push in August on the tour. I don't see any Chicago dates or Midwest dates. I'm very disappointed.
I promise, we're working on it. We're looking at late September, early October in the Midwest, and I think we have... Our long-suffering booking agent, who has had just a crazy year and a half, as you can imagine, is talking with a number of venues in Illinois and Michigan and kind of around the Midwest about getting a run of shows together around them.
Okay.
I wish we had them confirmed now, but sadly, I'm not in charge of the universe.
You're not?
As much as I try. I swear everything would be going much more smoothly right now if I was.
Now, when you guys are touring, are you focusing mostly on the 11 tracks from this album, or are you all stepping up with one or two of your solo offerings as well? Because it'd be kind of fun to have you guys promote your own stuff as well as the company package, so to speak.
We've been discussing how to approach that, and for this tour, especially for the dates that are coming up real soon, for our CD release in Austin next week and for some of these Texas shows in August, we're going to be focusing on Nobody's Girl songs. Because our early tours, when there only were like four or five Nobody's Girl songs, honestly, those tours were mostly Nobody's Girl arranging Rebecca Lobie, Betty Sue, and Grace Pettis songs. So for this tour, since we finally have enough original material as a band to fill out a 75-minute show, we're going to take advantage of that and focus mostly on the original.
Okay. And there are some videos up there. If you go to wearenobodysgirl.com, that'll give you an idea of what the live show is like. It looks like you guys are a bunch of college girls just having fun. What's the chemistry to keep it fun? So many times when you're out on the road and you're living in a bus or you're living in cars, you get on each other's nerves. You guys look like you're having a good time. Maybe it's just premature to say that because you are relatively new hitting the radar. But what keeps it fun? How do you make it so you don't get into catfights?
Well, we do have a lot of fun. We have really good community. I mean, sort of some very, very boring, very adult things. You know, we have really firm boundaries in terms of scheduling and, you know, what we're, you know, we all really respect one another's time. And when one of us needs to block time for family or for solo career stuff, there's no second guessing that. There's no pushing up against that. You know, we have band meetings where we talk things through, and there are three of us. We all have a lot of thoughts and feelings, and we allow everyone to express everything that they need to say, and we try and just really hold safe space for each other, and we know that we're three different individuals, and we're not going to necessarily have the same instincts or agree on everything right out of the bat, but, you know, we can always talk it out and come to an agreement on stuff. And we also have a lot of really secret, really silly little code words, like band meeting means, like, we need to go into that store and go shopping right now. So one of us will like see a thrift store on the road and point and say band meeting, and then we all go to whatever store that is. Or we'll, and also let's see, what's some other lingo. There's a certain coffee shop along the road that has lots of free Wi-Fi and delicious panini sandwiches, and we call that headquarters. So we said it's time to stop at headquarters. It's Panera. We go to Panera.
Okay.
Headquarters.
Free plug
and then
there.
We also take. Yeah, sorry, Panera. We take breaks for mandatory fun. So if one of us feels like things are getting a little stiff, we'll come up with a fun activity. This week we did a a rehearsal retreat at a house near a river here in Texas. And, you know, we're in this beautiful hill country environment, but we had to get through like 18 songs in 2 days, and we hadn't played together in a year and a half. So it was, we had our noses pretty firmly to the grindstone. But, you know, on the eighth hour of the second day, when we still had, you know, six more hours to go, I was the one who put my foot down. I was like, all right, guys, put your guitars down. We're going outside. Time for some mandatory fun. And we went to the river for an hour, and we felt much better afterwards.
Okay. Now, what's the touring ensemble like? Are you doing something low budget where it's just the three of you and guitars? Are you bringing a full band?
We're bringing our full band to the first few shows in Texas. And as we are traveling farther afield, we will be touring with the three of us playing two acoustic guitars, an accordion, an electric guitar, and keyboards. Wow. And we are swapping off a lot of instruments throughout the set amongst the three of us. And then, of course, very dense three-part harmonies.
So you all are multi-instrumentalists then?
Grace mostly, yeah, we are. Grace is playing acoustic and electric guitar. I'm playing acoustic, electric, and keyboard. Mostly I'm actually playing keyboard bass parts because I'm not like a virtuoso keyboard player, but I wanted to thicken a few tracks up. And I've been learning piano and keyboard during my 18 months of lockdown. So these will be the first shows that I've ever actually performed with keyboard in front of me. I'm really excited about that. And Betty Sue, yeah, she can play pretty much anything. She plays mostly electric guitar and acoustic guitar in the show, but she also will be making an appearance or two with her accordion.
Okay. Now, you're originally from Georgia, as I understand. How did you wind up in Austin? Was it because of that festival and meeting the ladies that you moved there?
I moved here back in 2009, kind of a while before the ladies and I formed the band. But I moved here just, you know, the music scene here was so compelling, and I had so many friends. And, you know, definitely going to the Kerrville Folk Festival was a big part of it, and I just think it's a wonderful, wonderful environment for songwriters. And there were so many Austin-based songwriters at the time that I met through the festival who just, you know, really, I don't know, they had a real strong sense of community in town that I was lacking in Atlanta in the music scene. I do love Atlanta, but I just didn't have that many comrades who were like full-time working touring musicians. So I decided to come out to Austin, give it a try, and liked it and fell in.
Okay. It seems like your family has supported your musical choice as a career, and obviously going to Berklee didn't hurt, but you got out of school, real school, regular school, I guess, when you were young. I mean, you graduated early. How did you pull that off and get into Berklee at such a young age?
Sure. Good question. So I have always been a pretty determined little person. And when the summer after my 10th grade year, I did some very simple math and realized that the school that I'd gone to as a freshman had a 32-credit graduation requirement, but then I had transferred to a different school that adhered to the state of Georgia minimum credit requirement of 22 credits. So at the end of my sophomore year, I had 14 credits. I only needed 8 more to graduate, and I was going to get 7 in school the next year. So I just had to take one summer school class in order to get up to the graduation requirement. And I thought, why would I stay in high school any longer than I have to?
Right.
So I took 2 summer school classes just to make my parents happy and to get the full 4 years of math and English. So I took summer school math and English after 10th grade and returned in the fall as a senior and graduated high school at 16. And, you know, it was actually kind of funny conversation at that point because my mom, you know, God, looking back, I can't really believe the position that I put them in, but I was just so, you know, I thought I knew everything, and I thought I was the most mature person on the planet and ready for anything. And my mom said, reasonably, in retrospect, you know, like, listen, if you're going to graduate a year early, I don't want you to think you can just take a gap year and just not do anything. Like, you need to go to school. How about we look at some good local Georgia schools for you to go to your freshman year, and then you can transfer somewhere when you're a bit older. And my dad, bless him, said, I don't want my daughter going to some podunk Georgia college. You know, there are a bunch of little schools in Georgia. And my dad looked his nose down at them and said, I'd rather her be a, you know, get some real valuable life experience, like intern at a radio station or be a roadie for a band. And my mom was like, oh my God, my 16-year-old baby, a roadie for a band? No, just go to music school. Just go to music school. And that conversation is basically how I got to go to Berklee just 2 weeks after my 17th birthday.
That's crazy. So you just moved out there on your own?
Yeah, 1,000 miles from home. They had three other kids behind me, and I'm the oldest of four, so I think I did seem, you know, relatively old and able to take care of myself, and they had their hands full with the other ones.
So did you wind up interning anywhere at a station or a studio or roadieing?
I did tons of internships when I was in college. All of those dreams came true. I interned at a bunch of different recording studios because I majored in music production and engineering at Berkeley, and so, you know, just to get more experience in the studio, I interned at a lot of studios. I ended up working at some studios. And then I never really roadied for bands, but I did a lot of stagehand work after I graduated. I worked on local labor crews in various cities up and down the Eastern Seaboard. In between tour dates, I would work as a stagehand, loading in and out for big conferences and events and concerts. I set up out on the West Coast, actually. I set up, like, the lighting rig for Kiss, which was kind of crazy.
Ooh.
I did, I set up like the stage for the Judds when they did the, you know, Country Music Awards in New York City way back when. And just, you know, I did a lot of setup and tech for big, big bands. And then I also worked as a backstage runner for a venue in Atlanta one summer when I was saving up money for my first big record.
So, you know, the ins and outs of the touring and road life and the studio. You have actually applied the term show business to the business side as much as the show, and I applaud that. A lot of artists don't.
You know, I think if you want to eat at a restaurant, you should be, like, legally required to wait tables for a little while first, just to have an appreciation for how hard work it is to serve.
Right.
And in the same way, I think it's really helped me to work in a bunch of different little corners of the music industry. I was my own booking agent, obviously, for years. Everyone is when they first start out. I will never, ever take the hard work of a booking agent for granted. You know, and I worked, you know, that backstage runner work, that was no joke. I got paid $100 a day, or maybe $125. And I was the first one there and the last to leave. I worked from 8 a.m. to 2 a.m. every show day. You show up and you get ice in the coolers for the guys who drive the trucks in overnight and help the grips get set up and put all the, you know, refreshments in them. Green rooms and fill the artists' riders and get whatever kind of crazy wine and coconut milk and organic snacks they want. And then, you know, the artists would come in on their tour buses and you drive them to their hotel so they can rest. Then you pick them up for sound check and drive them back. And speaking of Carol King, actually, I got into a major Carol King sing-along with the guys from the band Vertical. Was it Vertical Horizon or Train? No, it was Vertical Horizon. I was driving them to their hotel after a show one night, and one of them was running late getting into the van, and I said, oh, it's too late. And then I just started singing, it's too late, babe, and now. And then the rest of them just started singing, and we had like a 10-minute sing-along.
Wow. You got some great stories. You're going to have a heck of a memoir when you get a little older. I look forward to reading it and having you on the show again for that. So how is your solo career going to flesh out now that the Nobody's Girl stuff has taken off? Are you going to stop doing that? Are you going to do your solo stuff with the other ladies the same in and about the group tours? How are you going to work that?
We're just kind of weaving them all together into one beautiful, chaotic tapestry.
Okay.
I released my last solo record in 2019, right around the same time that Nobody's Girl was heating up. I was offered a record deal from a label in Houston called Blue Corn Music. And I'd been in, at that point, touring and performing for 13 years and had never nary a record label had I been offered. And suddenly I was offered two record deals in like a month. And I thought, are you allowed to have two of these?
Wow.
And I made sure that both labels knew about the other and everyone was cool with it. And just, you know, everybody's playing real nice together. And it's just, it's, you know, we all have a lot of different interests, you know, musically and in our lives. And I think that we're, you know, with the help of a very complex Google calendar, figuring out how to all make time for all of it. In fact, Grace Pettis, one of my bandmates, just released her debut on a label called Empress, which is a record called Working Woman, and it came out in May, and it's doing incredibly well. It's getting great Americana airplay, and her Spotify numbers are blowing up, and we're all cheering for her and very, very happy
great.
For her.
Let's talk briefly, because I know the listeners will crucify me if I don't, about the Voice. I don't want to dwell on it, but what made you step into the arena on The Voice? And you chose grunge songs to perform. That struck me as odd, because your voice is so not grunge.
Yeah. No, I mean, okay. I hope nobody from NBC is listening. But I'll just tell you right now that the idea that the national conglomerate that owns NBC would let some 27-year-old folk singer choose anything about their performance on national TV is sort of like a group delusion we all share in, because we put so much stock into what songs people choose to sing on those shows. But the big thing I learned once you get there is that they don't, nothing is left up to chance. Nothing's left up to choice. So I did end up singing these really fun, cool grunge songs. And I was very lucky that they let me have a little bit of input on the arrangement. But there wasn't really much choosing involved.
Wow. You never realize that. You just look and say, oh, this person has picked their song and picked this and picked that. And, you know, you just think that you're this calling the shots for your segment. But that's not the way it is, huh?
No, God, no. No, I mean, there are just so many hundreds of people involved in running the whole thing. I'll back up. What made me choose to do the whole thing in the first place is I got an email from one of the casting directors who had been gifted my song Mystery Prize for Christmas. It was just a real small town. She was dating a guy who I had gone, whose sister had been a friend from middle school. Like, just real, you never know who's out there. Mm-hmm. So she emailed me and asked if I'd be interested in auditioning for a new TV show. It hadn't been on the air in America yet. They were really rushing to get it out because they wanted to, like, get on the air before the X Factor. So I got the email around Thanksgiving, and the audition was in January. And I thought, well, you know, they don't pick singers like me. I sing original songs and, you know, play acoustic guitar and talk as much as I sing when I'm on stage. Like, I'm not a Kelly Clarkson diva singer. But I figured it couldn't hurt to go and, like, you know, take a backpack full of my CDs and give them out and meet some fancy people from Los Angeles. And maybe someday one of the PAs would run a movie studio and put one of my songs in a movie or something. Okay. So I go, and I think I was so confident that there was no way in hell that I was actually going to get picked for this show, that it just, like, came across as actual confidence in the audition, because I really didn't think it mattered. I didn't think it was going to happen. I didn't think I wanted to do it, even if it did happen. I was already, you know, making a very shaky living as a professional musician. I didn't feel like I needed it in order to, you know, arrive as a musician. And I think there was something about my initial audition that they found interesting and compelling. And, you know, when I'm being glib, I'll joke that there's something that people from Los Angeles find very attractive about not being wanted. And for whatever reason, they invited me back to a callback. And I tried to just stay calm and remember that it wasn't really the right fit for me anyhow, and I had nothing to lose. And then a month later, they called and invited me out to Los Angeles. So at this point, they presented me with a large list of songs that had been pre-approved for the show by legal and by the music directors. And from that list, we were given the opportunity to rank our favorites. And most of them I hadn't heard of. So any song I had heard before got into my top 10. And that's where Come As You Are came from. I'd never sung it. I had just, like, heard it before, grew up singing it, you know, in my basement, listening to the acoustic, you know, Nirvana record, the Unplugged album. And I think that they were surprised to see that matched so highly on my list when they were, like, you know, assigning songs, that they asked me to sing that one for my final audition. And at that point, I had to figure out how to sing it. And so then I sat on the floor of my dad's kitchen with my guitar in my lap and moving the capo around and looking up the chords online. And I just spent hours trying to figure out an arrangement that would make sense for me to sing that song. Because I wasn't going to sing it the way Kurt Cobain sang it. He already did it perfectly his way. Right. You know, I needed to find my way. So I made up my weird sort of jazzy way and went in and did that for my final audition. And I think they thought it was weird enough to put on TV.
Wow. It made the album too, didn't it?
You know, yes. And I was really proud of that because I did not make it super far on the show. I had a really fun blind audition. A couple coaches turned around. I was there for battle rounds. And you were saying earlier that you don't think music should be a competition. And I absolutely agree. So the whole battle round concept was very difficult for me. And I was singing, quote, against a 19-year-old kid who was a really good singer. He was an a cappella star at his college, and he was just as terrified as I was by the whole, you know, just scope and sheen and judgment of the whole thing. And we made a handshake agreement early in the week that we were not going to focus on the competition aspect of the blind audition. What I said to him was, listen, we have to sing a song together on national TV next week, and we can't control who they pick, but we can control trying to make it sound as good as possible. So let's just work together on this and let them take care of the rest. He said, that sounded good. So that's what we did. And we worked our asses off together on coming up with a really fun duet arrangement of the song Creep. And I'm still really proud of what we did. And I think we both sang really well. We had a really good time. He absolutely shone on the performance. He got picked to go through, won the battle round. I went home with my head held high. And my favorite part is that when they did my pre-show interview, they asked me all these questions, you know, when they do those talking heads moments.
Right.
And they asked me all these kind of leading questions, trying to get me to, like, talk some smack, you know, trying to get me to be competitive, which I'm just not. And they were saying, I remember they said, Rebecca, what's your strategy to defeat Devin? And I just snapped at the interviewer, and I was like, listen, I make my living as a full-time touring songwriter. I rely on other musicians on the road every day of my life. And to suddenly just step into some battle round and see another musician as my competition is absolutely unnatural to me. Can I just say something like that? And they said, don't worry, we've got it. And they put that whole speech in, like, as my, under a montage of me warming up, going out. And so that was my final statement on national TV on The Voice, was like, this is absurd to me. And also, I'm about to lose.
Good for you. Good for you. Have you stayed in touch with Devin then?
Few years since I've seen him. He's a chiropractor now, and he's doing great. Yeah.
Well, when the road
has... long time. I was on the first season. I was on 2011, the very first season, the very first episode. I was there.
Wow. Well, it's just about time to say goodbye. I would love to have you come back and talk more when you get to Dayton, Chicago. Let's have you back on the show, and we can talk a little bit about the live show and how the tour's been going and all the fun stuff, if that's okay.
I would love that so much. Yes, of course. This has been such a joy. I can't believe it. It just flew by.
It has. And RebeccaLobey.com is where you can follow her for the solo career and probably the Nobody's Girl as well. And then We are NobodysGirl.com as well. Good stuff. You got to listen to this, and I'm looking forward to it. I've heard some of Grace's stuff, but I have not heard any of Betty Sue's solo, so I'm going to definitely...
Worth a deep dive. Her voice will knock your socks off.
Well, I'm going to go back and do a song that I like. It's kind of a homage to the Naughty Girls, who don't need a white knight, and that is Rescued. It's my favorite song off the album right now, and we're going to play that. Is there any story behind it before we do?
You know, this song went through a whole bunch of iterations to write, and, you know, it started 100 miles from where it landed, and we just got kind of rowdier and rowdier with each rendition, so I'm glad you like it.
I do. I envision you guys just doing your thing in your little black dresses and just said, hey, guys, back off. Don't need your help. Thanks. Stand down. So it's a fun
one. Stand down.
Stand down. All right. This is Nobody's Girl off the Nobody's Girl album, self-titled, and it is coming out a week from today, you said, right?
Sure thing. Yep.
All right. Becca Lobey has been my guest. Thanks to her. Thanks to Cosmo Clifford. Doug Cosmo Clifford. Can't even get my guess right for the first hour. And I hope everyone will continue to support music and stick around for Chef Nick. His food show is coming up. And I'm just going to get out of here and go eat some lunch and listen to this album. Nobody's Girl. Thank you, Becca.
Bye-bye.
All righty. Adios, everybody. Stick around for Chef Nick.
Not sending up flares. No SOS. Don't call the national guard. It's just a little black dress. The trouble I find is the trouble I run.
good time.